From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the power of the mind and other supernatural things. Stand by for that. Here's what's happening. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is looking to overhaul the emergency alert system so that the president can speak to you at the flip of a switch in the event of a nationwide emergency. Now, the National Emergency Alert System broadcasts television alert messages right now and radio messages to warn people about immediate dangers. The system is often used at the local level to warn people about weather conditions such as tornadoes or flash floods. The system is not capable of reaching the entire country all at once should the president need to warn the public of something like a terrorist attack or an act of war against the country. Instead, to reach the entire country, each local jurisdiction would have to broadcast the same message, a tedious process that could leave room for gaps if one station, for example, misses the broadcast. So they are proposing a national location code that would give the president the ability to broadcast to the entire country with a single message in the event of a nationwide emergency. Last week's emergency surveillance legislation may have sounded like something out of George Orwell's novel 1984, but was cited as yet another real-life example of states trying to control you. It's been 65 years since Orwell described a fictional world of surveillance and manipulation by so-called Big Brother, and experts claim over the next decade, this fiction is about to become fact. The Net Threats Report from the Pew Research Center details that by 2025, the web will be governed by a system heavily influenced by governments, large corporations, and security services, all trying to control our behaviors. Privacy expert Catherine Albrecht with us. What do you think of this story, Catherine? What's it all mean?
Well, the Pew Research people did this in honor of the 25th anniversary of the Internet. It's hard to believe the Internet has been with us for 20 years,
Happy
but all through
birthday.
2014. Yeah, you know, it feels like it's been around forever, but the web in this form where you can go online and see pictures and click on stuff and watch cat videos, that's all fairly recent. So they reached out to a whole bunch of experts on the Internet all across the world, researchers and academics and activists, and they said, hey, what do you think is going to happen to the Internet in the next 10 years? And I guess the good news, 60%, around 60% of them said, it's going to be good. We're going to have more freedom and more people are going to be online and we're going to have lots of opportunities to communicate. But a third of them said, no, it's really going to be doom and gloom. It's interesting that they did this at this moment in time because there's a huge battle going on right now for something called net neutrality.
That's right.
And this is where the cable companies that are, for most of us, they're the services that are delivering the Internet into our homes and our devices and such. And they would like to have sort of a two-tiered Internet where if you pay more, then your content gets delivered faster and with better bandwidth than if you are just a regular peon. So what ultimately this could mean is that the Internet just becomes a big corporate entertainment delivery network instead of the awesome grassroots activist place it is. So I've teamed up with some folks at Fight for the Future. They've got a website, and in fact, there's 24 hours left, I think it's 36 hours now, to put in a comment to the FCC. And they are trying to get more comments to the Federal Communication Commission on this issue than any issue in the agency's history. There's a really easy form where you literally just go in and put in your name and click submit, and you can get your comment into the FCC. And let me give out the website for that.
Sure, go ahead, Kevin.
It's battleforthenet.com, battleforthenet.com. And I was trying to remember an easy way to remember it, and I was just thinking of like Star Wars battling. And on their website, they even show like laser beams. So it's battleforthenet.com. You can go on there, and in literally a minute or 2 minutes, you can have your comment going in to the FCC. And if we get all of the listeners to Coast, then those FCC guys are going to wake up in the morning and go, what happened?
Yeah, exactly. They're going to say half the country popped in on us. Catherine, thanks so much. The Israeli cabinet will meet in just a few hours to consider a ceasefire proposal that could provide a possible breakthrough in the ongoing crisis. The proposal put forward by Egypt calls for all sides to cease hostilities in Gaza. It also calls for the opening of border crossings once the country and the security situation is stable, and for high-level talks among those involved. We'll see what happens there. One of three cases of Alzheimer's disease worldwide is preventable, according to research from the University of Cambridge. The main risk factors for this disease, they say, are lack of exercise, smoking, depression, and poor education. Job losses at the Trump Plaza when the Atlantic City Casino shuts down in September will be even worse than expected. Trump Entertainment Resorts began mailing notices to many of its workers, informing them that while a final decision has not yet been reached, management expects to close the casino on September 16. Trump Plaza has been the worst performing of Atlantic City's 11 casinos and is one of three casinos currently operating that could close before fall. And the world economy, they say, is just as vulnerable to a financial crisis as it was in 2007, with the added danger that debt ratios are now far higher and emerging markets have been drawn into the fire as well. The head of a Swiss-based financial watchdog said investors were ignoring the risk of monetary tightening in their hunt for higher yields. Let's check in with the trends expert, Gerald Celente, trendsresearch.com. Gerald, do you agree with these people?
Sure. This is the Bank of International Settlements. I mean, George, this is the bank for central banks. This is the big one. And by the way, they came out also in 2004, and they had predicted the real estate bubble and the credit bubble. So this isn't a left-wing group here. And when you look behind the numbers, and they're putting them out there, you're looking at mergers and acquisitions now, just in the first 6 months, at $1.75 trillion. Yeah, that's a 75% increase from last year. And you just keep going down the list, whether it's the United States or anywhere, the M&A activity is up everywhere. As you mentioned, you're looking at the syndicated loans and sub-investment grade borrowers, that's up 40%. You keep going up and down the list. It's a Ponzi scheme. The only reason why the markets are going up is because of these record low interest rates. If I were to say to you, I got an idea, let's have negative interest rates, you would say, Celente, you're out of your mind. Well, they are out of their mind, and it's coming from Draghi, the European Central Bank, and don't forget China. This is who, by the way, the Bank of International Settlements is worried about the most. They see a real bubble popping there.
And if that bursts, it's going to affect us here too, won't it?
It's going to be the bubble pop turd around the world.
Oh, my gosh. Gerald, thanks. His website, trendsresearch.com. Listen to this strange story. Police in Utah are investigating after a man killed himself by jumping into a 30-foot bonfire during an arts and cultural festival on the weekend in the desert west of Salt Lake City. Just went running right into this fire, and off he went. Poof. A pair of U.S. representatives are pushing legislation that would remove some of the legal hurdles to commercial space mining. According to a copy of the proposed law obtained by Space Policy Online, private firms would be able to claim that asteroid materials are their property once the material has been extracted. The mine materials would then be considered private property under U.S. laws and subject to legal protections. That's just one of the many stories. We're going to check in with planetary scientist Dan Derda in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, some say it's not a matter of if, but when are we going to get hit by an asteroid and all these other incredible stories about asteroids? Dan Derda is a planetary scientist with the Southwest Research Institute. He has authored scientific publications, you name it, all about asteroids, and he is up to go into space. How soon is that, Dan? When could that be?
Hi, good evening, George. Probably for me, in that case, within the next year or 2 years or so, I'll be flying actually with two of the different commercial companies, Virgin Galactic and X-Cor Aerospace. And those flights are, as soon as they're ready to fly, as soon as those vehicles are ready to go safely, we'll be on board.
Strap a tape recorder to you if they will let you, and we'll play it back.
when you come back
down. Oh, you bet. You bet. Cameras and the whole shebang.
Oh, my gosh.
It's gonna be, you know, we're there to do work. I'm going to be flying to do research. It's not just a joy flight for me, but that's not to say that it won't be a joy, that's for sure.
Boyhood dream?
Oh, you bet. I mean, you know, of course, who wouldn't enjoy that chance to get to see that view? And
Oh my gosh.
I've done a lot of the bits and pieces of space flight, right? I've flown the high performance aircraft, time in F-18s and F-104s, so I've done the G's. I've done the zero G, lots and lots of zero G parabolas. I've done just about all the bits and pieces of flying in space except for that view. And I can't tell you. I just cannot wait for that view.
Lots to talk with you about tonight, Daniel. Asteroids, the possibility of impacts, the mining situation there, who owns the asteroids, and, of course, these new discoveries of planets and things that are out there. But let's start with the story I just had. And that had to do with representatives trying to push through some legislation that would remove the legal hurdles to commercial space mining. I mean, is there that much out there on asteroids that would be worth going there and mining and then trying to get that stuff back here? I mean, I see how much trouble we have just trying to load up trucks with stuff and, and get them to their destination from some mining section. How are we going to do it on an asteroid?
Yeah, no, you've raised exactly the right point. I think what we're going to see is that the, in fact, very valuable materials that exist on the small asteroids in the near-Earth environment, there really is a lot of good and precious stuff there. But I think the key, and I think you hit the nail on the head, the key is going to be that we're not going to go out there and bring the stuff back to Earth. We're going to go out there and mine the asteroids and use them for their resources when we have a viable working economy out in space. That's when that material is going to be valuable to us.
But
for exactly the reasons that you said. I mean,
sure.
It's hard enough right now, to mine the stuff on the Earth and, find ores that are precious enough, that are condensed enough in the precious materials to make it economically viable to go and open a mine here on the Earth. When you have to take that material, take the infrastructure it's going to take to do that sort of mining out in space, the last thing you're going to want to do with that material is dump it right back down into a deep gravity well, here on the Earth. It's going to, in a sense, where it's valuable is out there in space. Bringing it back to Earth, you might as well just go and mine the stuff right here on Earth rather than going out and doing it there.
What would they do with it, though, Dan? Just keep it on the asteroid?
Oh, well, it depends on what you're going to actually mine. There are lots of materials. You can go either after the precious iridium, the platinum group metals on the asteroids. Those are things, I mean, they're called precious metals precisely for that reason. They're very rare in the crust of the Earth, in the materials in the crust of the Earth. But on the asteroids, which are little worlds that never went through the same sort of geologic differentiation like the Earth did. The Earth is a big, big cake that's been cooked for, 4.5 billion years. It differentiated, it melted, and a lot of those precious metals like to go with iron down to the core of the Earth. And so they're effectively inaccessible to us. But the little asteroids never melted like that, or many of them never melted to that extent. And so they retain their original cosmic abundance of some of those rare metals like platinum and iridium and osmium and gold. Pound for pound, a typical asteroid rock is going to have a lot more of that stuff in it than a piece of rock off the surface of the Earth. And so, that makes that material very a very good ore, if you will,
for
that kind of mining.
Could asteroids be loaded with, let's say, gold?
Well, I mean, what we see on the Earth, not so much the way you might think of as an ore, the way we mine on the Earth. Many of the things that we consider ores on the Earth, those precious minerals have been, focused and condensed out by things like, hydrogeologic activity, hydrothermal activity, concentrating those ores along veins and so on. And so when you find a vein of that material, that stuff is in there in that very, condensed form, which is what makes it such a precious ore.
Sure.
In the asteroids, as far as we know, we've not seen samples like that yet that contain real condensed, like just literally lumps of copper or something like that. But in its more, dispersed form throughout, those materials are still relatively abundant compared to your typical rock that you're going to pick up on the surface of the Earth.
What about
diamonds?
You have to have a lot of carbon there.
Indeed, and we do find, in fact, diamonds, micro diamonds, in many meteorites. They're literally are micro. I mean, they're smaller than a grain of sand. They're literally microscopic, and those are there from the original interplanetary, interstellar dust grains from which our solar system condensed. That material basically comes out of the atmospheres of red giant stars and is ejected from supernova explosions and floats out there in interstellar space in the form of little dust grains. And some of that material was incorporated in the material around the sun from which our planets formed. And so we find these microdiamonds in meteorites all the time. I'm not sure they would be in the form that, you know, you're going to stick in a ring on your finger, but from the perspective of dust that you might use as an abrasive, that material could be possibly extracted and used in that way. Absolutely.
Are they finding any water on asteroids?
Oh, lots and lots.
Really?
In fact,
exciting.
A typical what we call a carbonaceous chondrite meteorite. These are about half of the types of asteroids that are out there in the main asteroid belt and in the near Earth population. They represent a somewhat smaller percentage of the things that we find on the surface of the Earth after they fall, because they're a little bit weaker than the other types of rocky things that we see. But in those more carbon volatile rich meteorites, many of them can have a significant amount of water bound into their mineral structure, as much as 5, maybe in some cases 20% water in these things. So, you know, you take the rock, you stick it in a test tube, you put flame to it, and you'll see water actually condensing at the top of the test tube out of the mineral structure. And like I said, some of these contain up to 20% water. That's going to be, quite frankly, more than the iridium and the precious metals. It's that water that's probably going to be one of the most precious resources that we mine from the asteroid.
Dan, what is an asteroid? Is it a planet that blew up, a series of planets that blew up, or just space material that just never coagulated to form a planet?
Yeah, the second of the options that you mentioned there. When the asteroids were first discovered, the idea was perhaps that it was a planet that had been broken apart in a collision with some other object or so on. Literally decades, centuries of detective work on trying to understand how the planets formed from the various clues, the properties of their orbits and so on, really do tell this story of this flattened disk of dust and gas around the newly forming sun from which the planets formed. And we have a pretty good sense of the disturbance, the gravitational disturbances caused by the really mighty, massive Jupiter growing out there in the outer solar system that stirred up that region just interior to it, that we now know as the asteroid belt. It kept that region from being able to accrete into a planet. And so it's really just the leftover debris, the fossil remnants of that early era of planetary formation. And that's what makes the asteroids so interesting to us as scientists, because they really are sort of the last remaining, best-preserved clues to that early era of solar system formation.
Now, this asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, what might have been there then? What do you think?
Well, basically what we see today as the asteroids are this remnant population, that original population was probably many, many times, you know, hundreds, perhaps, you know, 1,000 times more massive than we see it today. It's been, you know, degraded over time, again, by the gravity of Jupiter, tossing these objects out of the solar system into the sun, into planetary crossing orbits that then eject them out of the solar system. So it's really been winnowed down over the billions of years. But what was there is probably very much like what we see today, this remnant population of mostly rocky, a little bit of metallic stuff, and some icy stuff as well, represents the, you know, the condensed bits, the gravitationally stuck together bits of that original dust and debris that eventually grew into bigger bits to form the planets.
We're assuming, of course, that there are many solar systems out there that may have similar complexities as we have here. So I would guess that they could have their own, you know, portion of asteroids out there too, Dan, don't you?
Yeah, you bet. You bet. And we think we've actually detected that around many nearby stars. There have been a number of space-borne orbiting infrared satellites that peer out to the other stars, to the galaxies. The infrared portion of the spectrum, just beyond the visible red portion that we can see with our eyes, is a very good place, wavelength window, to study forming stars and so on, because much of the gas and dust out there, especially the dust, in the arms of the Milky Way galaxy, they look dark to us because, well, they're opaque to visible light, but transparent to infrared.
Dan, when we come back, we're going to talk about the possibilities of getting hit by one of these things next. Welcome back. Split show tonight, so we have Dan Derta for another hour after this half hour as we talk about asteroids and space exploration as well. Dan, so it's always not a matter of if, but when we're going to get hit.
Absolutely.
When could that be?
Literally any time. That happened to us about a year and a half ago with the impact of the object over Chelyabinsk. It came out literally out of the blue without warning. The orbit of that particular little object was such that it spent the previous couple months more or less in line with the sun from our point of view, which meant that it was, really not visible to us with our telescopes because we don't look toward the sun. We don't look in the daytime sky like that. And so that object plunged into our atmosphere unannounced, and that could happen at any time.
Most of the objects, too, that I've noticed that they find, Dan, these things have already buzzed past us. That's a little risky.
Yeah, that we see that a lot. When you look at the statistics, you go to the to NASA's Near-Earth Object Program page from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Those statistics are there and freely available, and you can kind of peruse, and you see exactly that many of these small objects are found only after they've made their close approach. It's roughly half and half. We see a few before their close approach. Many others we see after. It's those ones that we don't see after that kind of make the point for us that, it could just as well have been on an impact trajectory and we wouldn't have known about it.
What is NASA doing to try to help us prevent this?
Oh, quite a bit. NASA has been almost wholly responsible for funding the Space Guard survey, the previous generation of, and still ongoing, but it has effectively accomplished its job. The survey to find 90% or more of the kilometer and larger objects that could potentially hit us. These are objects that are about 0.6 miles across or bigger, and those are the ones you really, really don't want to get hit by. Those are literally the civilization-ending or the species-ending sorts of impacts. And of course, more than a decade ago, we recognized the severe consequences of an impact like that, and NASA took on the charge from Congress to be responsible for conducting that survey, funding that survey, and conducting it, and has done just a wonderful job. I mean, really, it really was a really great investment of taxpayer dollars. We've retired much of the risk from impacts, those sorts of catastrophic impacts of that scale. The focus now is more toward the smaller objects that have been up till now picked up only as a byproduct, if you will, of that previous search. And NASA has now recognized that we need to maybe think about a more focused, dedicated survey for these smaller objects, the things about a football field across or bigger, the ones that they're not going to wipe out civilization or our species, but you know what? It'd be really, really, really bad if it happened anywhere near your city.
It sure would. I'm going to give you sizes, Dan, and then I want you to tell me the possibilities of what you think, based on computer models I'm sure you've looked at, could happen.
Sure.
And I'm going to talk about a land-based hit or an ocean-based hit, okay?
Okay.
An object 300 feet across, if it hit on land in a city, what could happen?
Okay, so that's an object about the size of a football field or so.
That's right.
That's a little bit bigger, maybe about twice the size of the object that struck over Russia in 1908, the so-called Tunguska event. If it's a rocky object, 100 meters across, might just actually make it to the ground intact. It's kind of on that borderline between something that would break up in the atmosphere versus make it to the ground intact as a big survivable chunk to make a crater. So I would say for an object like that, very likely you're going to get maybe a couple of broken pieces making it to the ground, making a fairly sizable crater. This might be, you know, half a mile or, you know, 3/4 of a mile across sort of crater in the ground. That's going to make a blast probably several megatons of energy. That's gonna lay waste to your city, whether or not the object makes it to the ground and makes a crater. It's gonna still the blast from that would level your city.
Oh, jeez.
Not definitely not good.
If it hit in the water, would it create a tsunami?
We think so. If it hit close enough to shore, just off the continental slope, in some sense, an object like that might be even more dangerous as an ocean impact than it would be as a land impact, because any tsunami that's formed from that has the potential to spread, you know, along a much longer set of coastline, for instance. And if it's a, you know, pretty well-populated coastline, instead of devastating just one city, you may cause some damage in quite a few. 100 meters across, the tsunami might not be huge, but it might be comparable to something like what we saw in the in Southeast Asia back in, 2004,
okay.
I think it was. Pretty bad.
All right, let's step it up to about a 1,500-foot across asteroid that hits near a major city. 1,500 feet.
Now you're definitely going to be making a crater. That object, whether it's rocky or not, here I'm distinguishing between things that are kind of weak, rocky stuff, like many asteroids we know, versus something like a nickel iron, a stainless steel asteroid, if you will, the type of object that made the crater, meteor crater in Arizona. But at 1,500 feet across, whether it's rocky or not, it's going to basically make it through the atmosphere intact. That is going to make a crater, probably a couple of mile or a couple of miles across, maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles, something of that order.
Wow.
You're imagine blasting out a bowl-shaped depression in the ground, you know, much more than a mile across. Imagine the seismic energy involved.
Oh my gosh.
Let alone all the rest of the blast effects.
How deep is the crater at that point?
Well, typical craters are on the order of maybe a fifth of the depth is maybe about a fifth or so of the diameter. So, you know, if it's a mile across crater, it might be maybe a quarter mile deep, something like that.
Oh my God, that's a big hole.
This would be a big hole in the ground. I mean, meteor crater is a relatively small crater. Meteor crater is 3/4 of a mile across. It's over 570 feet deep. You could put the if you just kind of picture and imagine the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., take that monument out and stick it in the bottom of Meteor Crater in the bottom center, the tip top of the Washington Monument wouldn't clear the height of the rim of the crater. That's how deep now, that relatively small crater is.
Where does the material go? That material that then created that crater, that hole, whether it was, building material, concrete, dirt, where does it go?
Yep. Well, some tiny fraction of it is actually compressed and wedged into the walls of the crater, but the vast, vast majority of it is excavated and then ejected out of the crater and spreads outward very much the way you picture the blast of debris coming out of a bomb crater.
Or if you throw a rock, let's say, into a sand pile.
Yeah, the energies involved will crush rock into powder. At the contact point. Farther away, you fracture the surface rock in the earth that's being made into the crater, so you get these big blocks of ejecta rather than just powdered dust, if you will. But all that stuff is ejected out of the crater. It's splayed out across the landscape, flown for many, many miles radially away from the impact point itself. Within about a crater radius, that stuff is dumped into this very hummocky, hilly, rough ejecta blanket, if you will, that buries everything underneath it. This mile, 2 mile wide crater is going to create this ejecta blanket around it that's football fields, in length, deep, if you will. It's going to bury buildings and everything underneath it. Of course, what is buried that close wouldn't have survived the blast from the ejecta from the crater anyway.
Not at all.
Oh, it's literally absolute and total devastation for the blast zone around the crater like that.
Is death? I assume it's instant, isn't it? For people in that region,
if you're within an impact like that, if you're within you know, even several miles of the impact point like that, it is instant death, and like I said, absolute total devastation. Buildings would not survive; they'd be blown flat and then buried. That's really bad.
Could that region, with that mile 1500 foot diameter asteroid, could that region ever be brought back? I mean, could they fill in the hole? Could they bulldoze everything and rebuild? Or
well, yeah, I mean, effectively, instantly. I mean, you know, within, well, I mean, instantly.
That's,
I mean,
a big hole
to fill. Rain back out, but I mean, no, there's no radioactivity or anything like that. That's the distinguishing feature between. We often will make the analogy with these sorts of these blasts that are caused by asteroid impacts. We often make the analogy with nuclear blasts because that's the only thing, quite frankly, in our human experience that we have any context for understanding the energies involved. And from the blast perspective and that damage perspective, that's probably an apt analogy. But the one thing that you definitely don't get from an asteroid impact is the radiation. And so without the radiation, once the dust clears, literally you could move back into that place and try to start doing something with it. But in terms of it would be complete restart. There'd be no sense of any recovery. There'd be nothing left to do any recovery with. It would just be, as you said, almost literally, just bulldoze it and start fresh.
5-mile-wide asteroid, that's an earth killer, isn't it?
That's you're getting to sort of the extinction level event there. Our best guess, based on the size of the crater and the amount of debris launched around the world, that the Chicxulub impact that wiped out the dinosaurs and probably something like 3/4 of all the other species of plants and animals on the planet at the time, 65 million years ago, that was probably about a 6-mile-wide asteroid. And so, you know, your 5-mile-wide example here, you're talking pretty much on the edge of being that sort of human species ending event. It kind of would depend a little bit on where it impacted, but that's definitely on the border of kiss it all goodbye.
Would we see that one coming?
Yeah, very likely. That's in this category. On the upper edge of size, in this category that the Space Guard survey has done so well for us in terms of previous warning. We really now have retired pretty much all the risk from anything of that size in the asteroid population hitting us. So I'm not going to promise you that there may not be one or two hanging around still out there, but really from that size upward, we've found just about all of them. Which is really good news when you're worried about something impacting on the time scale of our lives or our grandchildren's lives. So from that perspective, fortunately that's moved off into the realm of sort of the history of the dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs weren't extinct because they didn't have a space program. Fortunately, we have the technology to have kind of surveyed the situation and at least in that sense bought ourselves a little time.
Dan, of a 4.5 billion year old solar system, which is what we are, the impact, for example, of all these objects on the moon, at what point did those hit the moon? Because, you know, the moon obviously was extracted from Earth, but when did they hit the moon?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you look up at the scarred surface of the moon.
God,
that's pretty much all you see is impact.
All over the place.
A large fraction of the largest impacts that we see there on the moon actually occurred within that first few hundred million years or several hundred million years after the formation of the Earth and moon itself. There's been really a sort of an exponential decay in the number of impacts over time, so that the last 3 billion years or so have been a pretty relatively quiescent stage. I mean, that's not to say there haven't been some significant impacts in that time, but most of the biggest stuff that you see on the moon, that all occurred in that several hundred million years after the formation of the solar system.
If you were to drain the oceans and just look at the planet Earth without any water on it, would it have the amount of impacts that the moon has? It should.
Absolutely, and not so much from the point of view of draining the ocean so you can see the ocean floor. It turns out the ocean floors are some of the youngest terrain on the planet. It's the continental crust that's actually the older stuff, and that's, in fact, where we see some of the very oldest craters on the Earth, the centers of the continents of Africa and up in Canada and Australia. But your point is absolutely valid. I mean, it's the fact that the Earth is a bigger target in space, We have a bigger gravitational cross-section, so we can affect the orbits of passing objects more than the Earth, more than the Moon. So you look up at that cratered, scarred, tortured surface of the Moon. For every crater you see there, the Earth has undergone maybe 20 or 30 impacts. So we definitely have not escaped that bombardment over time.
Wow, what a day it's going to be. You do know you'll be on the program if we ever get hit.
Well, I hope it's a small enough impact that there's something left that I can actually be on the program.
Yeah, I hope it's small enough we'll still have a program. My God. Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about this B612 Foundation's Sentinel Telescope mission. What is this?
Oh, you bet. You bet. And just for full disclosure, I have to tell you I'm actually one of the founding members of the B612 Foundation.
Okay.
I was the previous president, and I'm still actually on the board of directors of the
I always have respected your candor.
So I don't have quite neutrality on this, but I'm more than happy to tell you a lot about it.
Okay.
The basic idea with Sentinel is that while the ground-based telescopic searches that NASA is funding are doing a very, very good job, we could do a bit faster job and complete the search for these smaller sort of city-devastating scale impactors much faster if we had an infrared space-based telescope out there dedicated to this job of looking for these smaller objects near the Earth. And so what the Sentinel telescope is exactly that. It's a space-based infrared telescope. Basically a little spacecraft that we would be putting into orbit around the sun, much interior to the Earth's orbit, sort of in close to where Venus orbits the sun. Not that it's in orbit around Venus, but it's orbiting the sun much closer in. So basically that telescope is then looking back out toward the Earth, and it makes it very much easier to see these smaller, darker asteroids, especially when you look in the infrared where they shine very brightly.
Dan, It is amazing the things that are going on out there in space, the planets that they're beginning to find. In your estimation, was Sagan correct that there could be billions and billions of planets out there?
Oh yeah, I think that's the sheer joy that I have in watching the results from the Kepler mission, NASA's Kepler mission, which has found so many of these new solar systems that we're seeing out there. Combined with, of course, many of the ground-based surveys that are able to accomplish very similar results. Absolutely, I think Carl had it exactly right. We now know for a fact that we really do live in that sort of a Star Trek galaxy, if you will, where there's planets around just about every star out there, and not more than just like mere images of our own solar system, far more interesting solar systems, if you will. I mean, just ours is not, there's no such thing as a typical solar system, right? I mean, prior to the discovery of planets around other stars, the best example, the only example we had was our own system. And so extrapolating from that, you tend to think, well, we're probably more or less typical then. There shouldn't be anything all that special in that regard. Well, it's turning out that the architectures of the plans, if you will, of other planetary systems can be quite different. And that's been a joyous revelation for us to see what else is possible. And that, I think, that extrapolating from that, again, I think Carl had it right, that makes a wondrous, glorious stage for the play of life out there. And that's sort of the next stage. That's the natural leading point where this entire question is going. Why are we interested in finding planets around other stars? Well, of course, it's because we're interested in understanding, are we alone in the universe?
Who are we? Exactly. This, you can either look at it religiously, where many religious people, it's changing, but many believe we're the only ones here in the entire universe. I, since I was a boy, Dan, always believed that there were many civilizations like we have here on planet Earth. It's just a matter of trying to find them. But if they ever had, if they had a million years ahead of us, assuming all things considered, knowledge grows at the same level and pace it's growing now. If they had a million years ahead of us, can you just imagine the things they could do?
Yeah, I think that's the whole point. I don't think I can imagine what they could do. I mean, I think literally from that perspective, they'd be like gods to us, right? Technologically, it's like ants on an anthill trying to contemplate the things that we're doing, right? I mean, they're probably not even aware of our existence. We're so far advanced, we're just out of their sphere of influence from that perspective. So I think it was Arthur C. Clarke who said basically that any sufficiently advanced civilization, the technology of any sufficiently advanced civilization would be indistinguishable from magic.
so it's probably
quite literally going to be true.
Dan, we're going to come back, final hour with you. We shall take phone calls. It's your Space Hour next on Coast to Coast AM.